The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 325 for Monday, April 11th,
2011. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips, you send in cool stuff found. We try to answer your questions. We share all our tips that we can. And we have a great time here helping all of us learn more about the Mac and beyond. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And beyond. Well, that's cool.
Isn't it?
Is that good? I like it. To infinity and beyond. And
that's
this
right.
is John F. Braun here in sunny, warm Fairfield, Connecticut.
Yeah, it feels like spring. And it feels like spring here in Durham, New Hampshire. Hi, Pete.
Where? Who? Hi, guys. Pilot Pete here.
That's Pilot Pete, ladies and gentlemen. That's right.
Sounded good on this microphone. I like this one.
You've been grounded, Pete?
I like the sound of my own voice.
Yeah. You're on a slightly different mic today.
I like that.
Yeah. We have a lot of stuff to go through, and of course, we're not here next week because we're taking the week off. Is frankly why we're not here. So let's see what we can do here, John. Let's dive right in and see what Bob has to say. Bob says, "My wife and I got iPod Touches for each of our three kids. We initially set up allowance accounts under their own iTunes accounts, each with their own sign-on and passwords. That seemed like a good idea at first. Now, of course, they each want apps that the other has purchased, and we do not want to purchase them more than once. Do you recommend another way for families to share apps between kids, like signing them on under one of our accounts and just keeping track of how many purchases they can make? By the way, the same question pertains to sharing movies and songs purchased. This might be more of a lesson in parenting than that is how to share apps, but I appreciate anything you might be able to tell." Okay, so we run into the same thing here in my house. My guess is that this is a very common issue as kids are getting iPod Touches, and you're right to not want to have to buy an app more than once. You shouldn't have to. Apple's license doesn't require you to. You get to use it on all the iOS devices that you have connected and with the with everybody in your family. So we solve this here. There's a couple different ways. We have two accounts that we share amongst all our devices. And it was just sort of born out of how we had the account set up initially. But we use iTunes home sharing as kind of the cornerstone of this. And we can point to a Knowledge Base article about home sharing. But essentially what it does is it allows you to connect iTunes libraries on the same local network together and copy files back and forth between them. So in the past, you used to be able to mount someone else's iTunes library and stream songs across, so that you could hear music from another library. But with home sharing, you can actually copy stuff across, and it's not just songs. You can copy movies as long as they aren't rentals, ebooks, and of course apps. So being able to copy these apps across makes it easier, because now once the app's on your computer, you can then, of course, sync it down to your iOS device, and that makes life easier. So that's one way of doing it. And what's cool with home sharing is you can tell it to automatically copy new apps that it finds. So, for example, I have my thing set up with my wife's library. I don't necessarily want the music that she gets, let's say, but I want the apps that she gets. And so I can turn on apps and turn off music. And then anytime iTunes is open on my computer and it sees that iTunes is open on hers, it'll go across and say, "All right, what do you got for me? What new apps do you have that I don't?" And then it'll slurp them across the network. And then they're right there in my iTunes. So that's one way of doing it. And that, like I said, that's kind of the foundation of what we do here. But a lot of times you're going to want to put the app on your iPod without resyncing back to iTunes. I sync maybe twice a month with iTunes. I think my kids probably sync less than that. So what we'll do is we'll just go to the iPod and we know, okay, well, you know, we bought Infinity Blade with my account. So if my son wants that on his iPod, I just go into the iTunes store. I sign in with my account there and download. And it says, oh, you already own this. It's like, yeah, okay, fine. So you can have, we've talked about this before, but in a general sense, you can have apps on your iOS device from multiple iTunes store accounts simultaneously. And that's kind of the big picture of this. And then there's a couple of ways to do it. So you probably don't deal with this, do you, John?
No, because I think what I'm seeing here. So normally without home sharing, it sounds to me like my model, I have a single account and multiple iDevices and I can choose.
And you sync them all with the same Mac.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So my Mac,
right.
So I have a single machine where I have all my iDevice apps. Some go on the Touch, some go on the iPhone, some go on both.
Yep.
But they're all tied to, and I guess this is the issue here, without home sharing, they're all tied to a single iTunes store account.
No. Home sharing. So yeah, this gets a little confusing because home sharing.
Oh, it's not transcending that? Because it sounds to me like that's the issue, because he was saying he has, each of the kids has their own account.
Right. They do. And that's almost irrelevant that they have their own account.
Oh, okay.
Home sharing, but it brings up a good point, perhaps incidentally. When you set up home sharing on multiple Macs, you set it up on the first one, and you actually sign into an iTunes store account. Mm-hmm. And then in order to get home sharing to work on all of your Macs, you have to go and set up home sharing on each of them individually, signing in to the same iTunes store account that you used for the first one. But mm-hmm. it's important to note that this is not necessarily the same account you're using in the iTunes store portion of iTunes. It's very convoluted because you can, you know, like on my wife's computer, for example, perhaps it's helpful if I give the, you know, the real world example. So on my computer, when I turn on, I set mine up as the first one on home sharing. So I go in, I go into iTunes, I turn on home sharing, and it says, what account do you want to associate this with? So I associate it with my account that I use for my purchases. That doesn't change anything on mine. Everything's good to go. Now I go to my wife's computer and I go set up home sharing. Now she logs into her own iTunes store account. But when I'm setting up home sharing, I say, connect it to my iTunes store account only for the purposes of home sharing. And all that does, it has nothing to do with what apps can or can't be transferred. They all can. All it does is there needs to be some centralized way at Apple's servers to say, ah, yes, all of these computers are authorized to home share. And you do that by linking them to one iTunes store account. But again, it's abstracted from the data that can be shared. Any data can be shared other than movie rentals. Okay. And it doesn't matter what account they were purchased with. Yeah, it gets very, very convoluted, but only because you're using terminology and accounts that can be used for both purposes. So hopefully that makes sense. Yeah, it is kind of funky. But if you go to their knowledge base article, and it will walk you through setting this up, they did a decent enough job of explaining it that I was never confused through the process, despite the fact that explaining it is a very confusing process. Does that sound good?
No, I'm confused.
How do you deal with this at your house, Pete? You have you must have multiple. I know you have multiple iDevices.
Yeah, I do. Frankly, we haven't done much with the Apple TV 2.
Oh, that's right.
You know, I put the main library with all the stuff on it on the Drobo in the basement, which is a NAS drive.
Right.
But when it comes to just sharing, I've enabled my son's iPod to share my apps on that. That I've got on my iPhone, and that's it. I mean, I really haven't. So I wish I had a better answer.
No, you know, the simpler, the better. If you don't mind sharing one iTunes store account amongst all your devices, which includes, you know, all your kids' devices and all that, if you don't mind everybody having access to it, it really does make things simpler. The only issue is, for example, if, you know, in my example that I used before, so I bought Infinity Blade. I put it on my son's iPod Touch. It's now authorized under my account. So if an update comes out for Infinity Blade, my son now has to go type my password in.
Oh, okay.
When it updates on his iPhone or his iPod Touch. So And the question is, do you want to, you know, give kids passwords? I mean, it depends on how you organize your life, but that, you know, that's the only part where it gets somewhat convoluted.
Right. So. And I do have two iTunes libraries though. I mean, and it was more important when I had podcasts that updated regularly and that sort of thing.
Right.
So I kept them basically on my hard drive, yet I kept all the movies and that sort of thing on the NAS drive in the basement. If I was going to go on the road, I'd grab three or four movies, throw them on there so I could have them on my,
yeah,
on my laptop.
Sure.
That's how I try to keep it simple. All my music, all my movies and all that are on the NAS drive.
And everybody sees it.
Yeah. And then the applications, and even though my wife has an iPhone, she's not interested in any apps. You know, why do you have an iPhone? But my son has the iPod Touch and, I've authorized some app sharing with him. And so same thing, put in the password and he's good to go. Yeah.
So Dave or what would, if you had to start from scratch,
I'd do one account.
That was my question.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've got two here and it's not too bad, but I could see where having five accounts would be terrible. And if you are at a point where you've got five, just pick one and, you know, buy all your new stuff on that so that at least down the road, you've got something or homogenize the passwords across all five, so it doesn't matter anymore.
Oh, there you go. That's probably the simplest, you know.
If you're stuck in that position,
people you can trust, yeah.
Right.
It sounds to me like the intent here was to give each child a certain number of credits and a certain level of buying ability.
Right.
You could do that with the iTunes gift cards for their account, obviously.
Well, but then they have to have their own accounts.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an imperfect scenario. Yeah. There's no one magic answer. We do it. And I mean, we go through the same thing that Bob's going through. You know, we just keep a spreadsheet of app purchases and the kids know they're not allowed to purchase any apps without clearing it with us. And when they do, then we just mark it down and we say, okay, yeah, buck here, buck there. And at the end of the month, we settle it up and that's that. Yeah. But yeah.
Okay.
So it could be a better system.
Okay. So it is as he was saying, so it's both a technological, but perhaps also a parenting issue.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You got to figure out what works for you. Yeah. Along these lines, Chris writes, he says, in my quest to slim down the data on my drive in preparation for replacing it with a smaller SSD, I found that many of my iPhone or iPad apps are duplicated. The duplicate file names end in space 1 or another number .IPA. Given that my apps take up 13 gigs of space on my disk, I'm wondering if it's safe to simply delete the duplicates, the ones with the space 1 at the end of their file names. So this is interesting, John, because I've seen this happen on mine, but I don't have a magic answer as to why. iTunes does sometimes keep older versions of apps when it's doing an update. And again, I can't tell you why, because it's not every app. And I think it's happening less and less frequently. So it clearly it happens. The trick is that sometimes that file with the space 1.IPA is the new one. And sometimes it's the old one. So you got to figure out which one you want to keep. And for me, the easiest way to do it is to go into iTunes, click on apps, find the app and do a get info and see what file names associated with it and then delete the other one. That's what I do.
Huh.
And I think more often than not, the space 1 or the one with the higher number is the newest one and is in essence, not the duplicate, but the current use one.
You know, I got to say, I have not run into this. Now, maybe it's because I only have a single account. I have noticed now looking at some of the apps. So what I'm looking at, Dave, is if I go to music, so my music folder, iTunes, then within that is a mobile applications folder.
That's right.
That is all the IPA, which is an iOS app file.
Right.
And some of them do have typically a 1 after them. And I'm trying to wonder if it's either due to an update occurring. There's only one app that I know where it's two apps that are both called Discover.
Okay.
Which is kind of wacky. One says Discover and the other says Discover Space 2. One of them is the Discover credit card app. The other is an app called Discover that does some level of file sharing. And I see that occur twice. And that's the only one where I see a 2. But I do also see some that do not have a version number that is something dot something dot something, but it's the name of the app, a space, and then a one. But I do not see, and maybe it's because my system is relatively simple and that I only have a single iTunes account. I don't see any apps that are duplicated where one app is there with just the name and the other is a space one dot IPA. So I,
when did you start using a device? And I'm going to guess it was an iPod Touch, knowing what I know about your computing history here. But when did you get your first iPod Touch and actually start using apps? Because I think this problem, I think this problem has been solved. Okay. Exactly. And I think it only exists for older, you know, apps that were downloaded before they solved whatever the problem it is that caused this.
Well, I'm looking, and if I look at the date modified, I will see that my oldest app is around 2009.
Oh, okay.
And up until earlier this year, that's when I got the iPhone, and I'm starting to sync to one or the other. And of course, unchecking, as we've discussed, there's that checkbox somewhere that says automatically sync apps, which I disabled because I don't necessarily want all the apps on both devices, either because they won't work or it's just my personal preference.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So I see what you're saying. So maybe if you've been running an iDevice for a while, you know, of course they migrate when iTunes upgrades.
Right.
So maybe this is old cruft. I think, as you pointed out, you could whack it and.
Well, yeah. The worst thing that happens if you delete the one you wanted is you just re-download it. I mean, all the stuff's still available in the store, unless you've got some app that was pulled from the store, in which case, you know, guard it with your life. But
that?
What's that?
They do that.
Occasionally. Yeah, it's happened. It's usually when a developer, you know, sneaks one past the goalie, you know, and then they find out, hey, wait, you know, that flashlight app is actually a tethering app. Who knew, you know?
That was cute.
Yeah. There's a couple of those out there, other than that, you're safe because Apple will let you re-download for free, but presumably an unlimited number of times, though. If you tested that theory, they might have some limit, but we haven't heard of it yet. So. All right. You know, let's talk about our first sponsor here, John, and that is Barebones Software. And I love Barebones. They make cool stuff. I think their logo or their motto is they make stuff that doesn't suck, which is great. I want to talk today about BB Edit 9. BB Edit 9 is the text editor to beat all other text editors. And you might think, well, I don't need a text editor. Well, you might not. But if you do any sort of coding, and I'm talking all the way from, you know, high level C stuff to simple HTML editing, you might want BB Edit 9. It really works so smoothly, and it's built. Yeah, it's really cool because it's built by programmers and they use it themselves, right? I think BB Edit is written with BB Edit. It is the editor that they use to edit all this code. So, you know, these are programmers that get to write the app that they use to work all day. And so this thing is totally tweaked out. If you're writing even just HTML code, it'll automatically pick up on the fact that, this is an HTML document. And then it starts highlighting things automatically without you doing anything and really making it easy to see the flow of the code. It'll figure out that you've got sections or formulas or functions, depending on, you know, what language you're in, and allow you, you know, the little triangle twisty thing that you get in the Finder, John, when you can open and close a folder in list view.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can get that inside BB Edit. For a function, right? So you write a big long function and then you want to scroll through your code and you don't want to necessarily see down deep into every function. You can twist it and fold up the entire function, which is just so cool. I mean, it doesn't edit it. I mean, when you type, it edits, but by twisting up the function, it doesn't change the way your code works. It just changes what you see. And it's so cool. They've got, you know, multi-level find. You can find across multiple files, even if all those files are on an FTP server. So if you have a website and you've got, you know, your files up on a server and you want to go and search through them, you can actually do this with BB Edit. If you do anything at the command line, it installs a command line tool. So if you're around in the command line and you decide, oh, I want to edit that text file, you don't have to use VI or Nano or Emacs at the command line. You can type bbedit space and the name of the file, and it actually launches it in the GUI version of bbedit, which is pretty darn cool. Bbedit, of course, is from barebones.com. It is available as a trial download, of course. So that's the right way to start. And then once you're hooked, it's $99, and you can buy it right there at barebones.com. If you're a student, you get it for half price. Well, even slightly less than half price, $49. So go check it out. Barebones.com. BBEdit is probably one of those apps where a day does not go by where I don't launch it for something. It's just so powerful. Even if I'm not doing code, if I'm just doing lists, if I want to resort a group of text, it is my go-to app for just about anything. And it's cool.
I use it nearly every day. Well, I use it at least once a week because I use it to lovingly handcraft our show notes because I kick it in HTML.
Right.
And once it realizes HTML, it does a great job, as you point out, to color code everything.
Yep.
So you make sure you're doing it properly.
And the cool part is in the file menu, there's both quit and a sleep command. So one of the most frustrating things is, you know, to get six different files open if you've got a project you're working on or whatever, and then have to quit and close all those files. And then when you come back, you got to reopen them all. And it's got great ways. It's got a cool way of managing projects in there so you can have multiple files associated. But even that, sometimes, you know, you get started and, okay, well, now I'm at the beginning of every file. I don't want to be there. I have to relay out my windows. They've got a sleep command. And sleep quits the app, but it saves everything. And when you relaunch the app, it all comes back. The windows are in the same spot. Your cursor's in the same spot. It's awesome. So barebones.com, bbedit. Go check it out. You won't be sorry. I don't think you will be. All right. We have an interesting question from Bill. It gets a little convoluted, so I think I'm just going to try and paraphrase what he's looking to do. Because the eventual solution here is something that is not necessarily obvious, but a handy thing to know is possible. And that's kind of what we try to do here, folks, right? We try to take these questions that come in and answer the question for the person that's asking it, but also try and share as much as we can with you to kind of increase your knowledge base, right? Because we know that every question doesn't immediately apply to every listener. And so that's how we roll. So Bill writes, and again, I'll start reading and then I'll paraphrase a little. When I first got on a Mac 3 years ago, I didn't set up separate user accounts for my wife and me. Coming from a 9-year-old machine running Windows 98, it simply never entered my mind. Belatedly, I have set up separate user accounts. Among the things we shared was Apple's Mail app, although we certainly each had our own email addresses. Now I want to move all of her existing email messages from her inbox stored under my user account to her inbox stored in her user account. I tried simply copying from the mail library and moving it through the shared folder on my Mac to the library folder in her account. And while the messages can be read, they don't show up in her inbox. I then thought of archiving and importing. I'd never archived a mail inbox before. And I think that this would have worked, but I got myself into trouble and we talked. So we'll stop right there. So there's a couple of things that you could do to solve this problem. If you were able, and he wasn't clear about where these messages appeared once he put them in her library folder. But if you were able to open them in mail and maybe they came in a different, you know, archive mailbox or something like that. The inbox is a mailbox like any other, and you can drag things into it as well as out of it. So if you've got the stuff open in mail and you can manipulate the messages, just drag them to her inbox and you're good to go. That's certainly possible. And I do it all the time. I bring stuff, you know, if I accidentally archive something and I think, oh, I want to go back to my inbox, I just put it back in the inbox. Right. I mean, there's nothing special about that mailbox, except that's where new mail also happens to be delivered. Right. Is that fair to say, John?
I'm still trying to parse this because I think there are some. Let me toss in what I'm thinking while you're talking.
Okay.
Which I sometimes do.
Yes.
Is that I see a conflict here. So there is user accounts and then there's mail accounts. And I think at some point along the way here, they may have gotten. Well, then I see an attempt here, which sounds like Bill was digging into the low level actual folders on the computer. And I don't know if I would have done that. I see shared folder mentioned here, and that makes me a little bit nervous. Attempting to deal with mail at that level, I don't know if I would have necessarily done that.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. I mean, he's dragging stuff out of the library folder into the shared folder and then into his wife's library folder on the other user account, right?
I would have not gone to that level. Now, again, he says he was running Windows, and I'm not trying to be insulting, but it sounds like a Windows way of solving the problem, in that I think it could have been done through the application itself without having to... Because I don't think you should ever be fiddling with the actual folders from the Finder when you're dealing with most apps, at least in this case.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, I think that would have worked. I don't know how else he would have done it. I mean, I have another solution. If he's running an IMAP account, there's an easy solution, right? If both he and his wife have IMAP email accounts, the easy solution is to connect both inside his mail program, right? If he's got all of her mail stored in his mail program, then set up the IMAP account for his wife there as well, and then simply drag the messages into her IMAP mailbox, and then turn off the IMAP account on his wife's side, or on his side, turn off his wife's IMAP account from mail in his account, and then go over to his wife's user account, connect that up to her IMAP mail account, and the messages will just magically be there, right? Because that's how IMAP works. The messages are actually all stored on the server, so whatever you manipulate on your computer is replicated on the server, and if you sync up another either computer or account there, boom, they all come back down. So I wasn't sure if he had IMAP, but that would be an easy answer. And like you said, it lets you work within the framework of mail, John, right? Instead of going out and having to monkey with the file system and all of that good stuff.
Yeah. The only other thing that occurs to me is that there was mention here of archiving within mail. And when I dug into archiving from mail, I think this is another problem, which I don't think it's necessarily clear that when you do this, but based on the documentation that I read, I think this is a problem with the way mail app, at least mail app, handles archives, is that if you archive a mail folder, and I think he said he ran into this. So if you archive a mail folder, okay, yep, great. It creates a folder with all the mail. The problem is, I think what happens is if you try to archive it again, and I think this is maybe a problem with the way mail handles it, and maybe it's, I don't know if it's the right way to do it, but if you try to archive again, based on what I read in the mail documentation, it's not going to create an archive that is inclusive. It's going to create an archive that's going to be a delta between what happened before and all the new stuff. And I think that could bite you. And I think that's what may have happened.
Yeah, it did.
Properly.
Right. Yeah. The other half of the message that we didn't read goes into a whole convoluted thing with archives. And yeah, you're right. It could have worked, but archiving in mail is a little funky. I think it's the right term.
The one that'll let us keep our clean rating, but I don't think it's necessarily intuitive to me. Archive implies you're archiving everything in the item that you selected. It's not a delta. So,
right. That's right. Yeah.
Or it should give you a choice saying, hey, you want to archive everything, or you want to archive just the new stuff.
Right.
And I don't think it makes it clear. The only other thing I mentioned in this is that, and we touched on this in the past, then I at least was kind of amazed that this happened, but there's always looking at the mail trash, working again within the confines of the mail app. There's always, if you're using Time Machine, there's always the possibility that you could retrieve things that are lost, because it sounds like that's what happened here, is that you could always try to retrieve things that are lost if you go into the trash, because as you and I found, Dave, again, to my surprise at least, the trash being just another folder is archived as well. Or not archived. I'm sorry. It's backed up by Time Machine.
By Time Machine. Okay.
Huh. So, because he's saying it sounds like some messages were lost. So,
right. Well, no, he didn't say any messages were lost.
Oh, all right.
No, it was just that, well, he had deleted, and again, this kind of goes deeper than we need to go here into his particular thing, but he had created an archive and then deleted the archive, but he didn't delete any of the messages from within mail.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, we're cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Because you're saying, again, assuming IMAP, because I didn't see IMAP or POP mentioned here.
Yeah, it's hard to know. But, you know, still, I think you could grab the messages from the library mail folder. I know it's not perfect, but I think in this case it would work. Just make a copy of those, pull them in, and then just copy them once you're inside mail on her end. Just copy them to the inbox. Mm. And there's nothing wrong with copying to the inbox from within mail. It works fine.
Right.
All right. This was interesting. We got a couple of emails about this during the last regular show. I think it was 323. I started us on a little tangent because I noticed my CPU usage was spiking, and it turned out, right? Remember this? It was that I had Time Machine.
Your mini tale of woe, which I don't know if it was a tale of woe, but it was certainly something happening that you weren't expecting to happen, especially chewing a processor while we're recording the show, which.
Right. And what it turned out to be was Time Machine had, for whatever reason, decided to that it had to verify my backup volume. And so that's what it was doing. And that's what was eating all the CPU. I made the perhaps critical error of just killing off that file check process. And yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about this. So. Here's the interesting thing.
Well, that was the FSCK. It was running some FS.
FSCK underscore HFS, I think was the name of the process. And that's just checking the file system of this sparse bundle. So we got a couple of emails about other people that were seeing exactly this or the result of this. And Adam kind of encapsulates a lot of what we saw. Adam says, here's my setup. I have a 1.5 terabyte Seagate drive connected to my Airport Express via USB. I've been using it as a Time Machine repository for about a year, primarily for my MacBook. It's been working without incident all this time over wireless and sometimes Ethernet. A G4 Mini and a PowerMac G5 do backups to this drive over Ethernet as well. A couple of weeks ago, I got a message on the MacBook saying, Time Machine completed a verification of your backups. To improve reliability, Time Machine must create a new backup for you. This is the same message I saw, John, after killing off the FSCK underscore HFS process. And there are two options. One is backup later, i.e. bring this message back up at another time, or start a new backup, i.e. wipe out my old backup. And, and it even says this will remove your existing backup history. This could take several hours. He says, I let it do a new backup. It removed the old one, and over the next day or so via Ethernet completed a new backup. I let it do a second cycle of verify and create new after the message reoccurred a couple of days later. My problem is now it wants to do it after every complete backup. This is obviously not how Time Machine is supposed to work. So for the moment, I have an aging snapshot of my hard drive and I'm not backing up any new data. So in looking at both his logs and my logs, it seems that Time Machine will, if this file system check fails for any reason, now, of course, it could fail because there is something wrong with the backup bundle, but it could also fail if, for example, the user quits the process, i.e. what I did. And there doesn't seem to be a way to tell it, oh, reset that and try again. No, it was not interested in trying again. We were going to go ahead and wipe this backup out, and that was that. So I've wound up with a new backup, which is nice, you know, little house cleaning, lost some, or gained some space on my time capsule. That's always nice. Of course I don't have my backup history for this machine anymore, but I'm okay with that. That's not a problem. The question is for Adam, John, why this keeps happening. And I'm sort of at a loss. I'm guessing that it's creating a new sparse bundle every time for him. And I assume that's what it did for me too. but maybe it didn't, right? Maybe it's maybe it just emptied out that old sparse bundle and is repopulating it. And if he's got some, you know, I don't know. It seems it's a stretch. I don't know why it would keep telling him this.
I'm with you because actually that message, and it's in a support article because, yep, you know, I'm all about support articles.
You are
HT 4076.
All right.
And it's funny because that article has been archived and is no longer updated by Apple. If you look at the link I sent you in our chat room.
Huh?
But no, what this is indicating is, as you pointed out, and they actually go into detail about what this means. Basically, it means, I think, when you boil it down, yeah, your backup image is corrupt and I want to wipe it out.
So wait a minute. I'm gonna point something out here. This article was archived and no longer updated by Apple, as per the banner on the article itself. But it was updated at February 16th of this year.
Yeah.
So it's not that old.
Kind of, I mean, funny,
it's,
huh?
You know, it's less than 2 months. Well, actually, 2 months exactly. You know, almost. Yeah, less than 2 months.
And as long as they don't kill their backups, it won't disappear.
Well, I'm hoping somebody at Apple's making backups.
Yeah.
But anyways, now what occurs to me is that. And they go into detail. They're saying, well, this comes up, yeah, when we detect a problem with the sparse bundle. And then they actually go into detail saying, well, hey, if you want to do this yourself, which you don't have to anymore, because now it's, of course, in the Time Machine, you know, if you hold down the option key, you can say verify backup. They actually told you how to do this manually, which I think involved running disutility.
Okay.
And actually mounting that sparse bundle, which I think is basically what that choice does now. But I think all paths lead to the fact that that sparse bundle is somehow corrupted. Now, I'm wondering, is it because I think he mentioned it's a external drive. It sounds
actually,
like it's having a problem.
It's an air disk that he's using.
Connected to his, Airport and I think before Extreme. You said And yeah, I think before you said Express, but it's yeah, it is Extreme.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if for some reason there's some problem with that drive, because it sounds like it can't make the new sparse bundle, because it sounds like what that command is saying is I'm going to trash everything and make a new one. And it sounds like it's having difficulty doing that. So that's why you keep getting that same dialogue. So
I don't know. He says it wiped it out and created a new one.
Oh, but that message keeps coming up.
Exactly.
Ooh, oh.
And that's why I'm not.
I wonder if that disk is faulty.
Yeah, I'm not entirely convinced
that
it created. Well, he's got other machines backing up to it. I'm not entirely convinced that it created a new one, but I have the ability to check at least and see what happened on my end here. So while we wait for my time capsule to spin up, because that would be the thing if this new or if the current. Thing the current sparse bundle for my iMac now it was created Monday April 4th at 5:46 p.m. which is right about the time when I threw in the towel and decided to let it create a new bundle, so it is creating a new one each time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense. I don't know the magic answer on this. I would run a verify with disk utility on that.
Yeah.
I would follow these instructions for Adam here. Follow these instructions that John found in the knowledge base article. At least you'll see what error is being reported.
Right.
And it might not be, you know, remember what I said before, if FSCK fails for any reason, including that I simply forced it to quit. Right. I mean, this is not. I found a problem. This is, I died, you know, and it could be anything, right? You could have some memory problem on your computer that causes FSCK to die. There could be some problem with FSCK and the file itself is corrupt. And that's what, because it's just another program, right? So it's quitting for some reason. And if you can see what that reason is, and you'll get more data inside a disk utility, that might help. That's my thought anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing that occurs to me is that technically this is not a supported configuration, right?
Yeah, you know,
air disk connected to, even though it works, like I think I mentioned to you, my mom set up like this.
Is it still unsupported though? Because I think that's changed.
Well, here's the thing. Well, the thing is, I think you can do it, but they tell you it, and I can do my Google foo and find the support article.
I'm sure you can.
I don't believe that a drive connected to an airport Extreme via the USB port.
Yeah.
Although I know lots of people that do this, including my mom's setup like this. And last I was over there, it's working just great. Time Machine sees it. I don't think that is an officially supported configuration. Connected to a time capsule, yes.
Right, right.
To a Airport Extreme, although I think they're pretty much equivalent, except, of course, the Airport Extreme doesn't have a hard drive inside of it. I don't know if it's maybe he stumbled across some bizarre bug that is why they don't recommend this.
I thought that went away. I thought it became a supported configuration with the newer breed of Airport Extremes. But I could be wrong. Because you used to have to use a hack to enable it. You used to have to go to the command line and basically say enable it, even though I know it's not supposed to be enabled. But now you don't even have to do that anymore. So I don't know. We got to find that knowledge base article and see if it still exists.
Yeah, I'll see what I can do.
Okay. All right. I will play Andy's question here, which has an interesting but relatively simple answer.
Hey guys, it's Andy from the University of New Hampshire. I have a weird audio routing thing that I'm trying to figure out how to do, and I'm wondering if you guys have any brilliant suggestions, since all your suggestions are usually brilliant. I am running Windows XP inside VirtualBox on my Mac, running Snow Leopard, for a legacy application that happens to be an audio measurement tool that I use for calibrating sound systems. The problem is, I have an audio interface, which is a multi-channel interface. It has a bunch of inputs and a bunch of outputs, connects via FireWire. And what I want to do is route one set of the inputs on it into my VirtualBox and one set of outputs from the VirtualBox to a set of physical outputs on the device. VirtualBox will send audio through Mac OS X's default output, whatever you select in the sound preference pane. But there doesn't seem to be any way to direct it. And I'm wondering, I mean, maybe this is an Audio Hijack Pro thing, which would be fine. I just haven't had a chance to try it. Or maybe there's some more kind of direct way of doing it. So I would appreciate your wisdom. I do lots and lots of audio, but have never used VirtualBox before this. So thank you very much, and this is where you cut me off.
All right. So it's important to note VirtualBox. Go ahead, John.
Well, no, I just want to mention is that, so I have VirtualBox, and I looked at this, Dave, and now to begin the discussion, VirtualBox gives you two choices if you enable audio through VirtualBox.
Okay.
So one is the host audio driver. And the choice that I see here is Core Audio, which last I checked is the audio framework that's in Mac OS X. So that's a good thing.
Yep.
And I think that's why it works at all, is that it's tying into the Core Audio service. Here's the weird thing, though, is that the audio controller is that you get a number of choices here. Now, the thing I have it set up for is ICH space AC97, which I think is some emulated sound chipset. It also does Blast from the Past, Sound Blaster 16, and Intel HD Audio. So I'm wondering, so one place to look is that you have three choices there as far as what type of audio device you want it to emulate. I wonder if that may figure into it, but you've done more audio than I have, but I just want to set the groundwork here.
All right, so you
in what VirtualBox thinks it's doing when it's looking to the Mac to provide audio services.
Okay, so if I understand this correctly, there are two sides. VirtualBox, as with any, it's not emulation, it's virtualization software, right?
Right, right.
It has two faces, essentially, to every hardware device. There is the actual hardware device that it's talking to on the Mac side, so I'll call that its external face. And then its internal face is how it registers that with Windows. And of course, the magic of all this virtualization software is the layer in between, right? It's got this outside face and this internal face, and it's got to marry them together. So You're talking about, right? Okay. So its external face is that it's going to talk to core audio and there are no other choices, right?
Well, and, the only, well, there is.
What is the other choice?
It's null audio driver, which to me implies, yes. I think that means no support.
Yeah. Ixnay. That's right. Yeah. So,
and then audio controller is, I think, yeah, as you said, how it appears to the Windows virtual machine.
It's going
to
emulate that ICH AC97 or a Sound Blaster 16 or whatever on the inside. So the question is, you know, what do we wire up here? So we are limited. We know that the Mac is talking to this board that he's got, this audio interface that he's got, but it's only talking to core audio. And I actually heard from Andy today and he confirmed this, that the only way to choose the audio devices that go in and out of VirtualBox is to go into the system preferences on the Mac OS X side, go into system preferences sound and set your input and output sound. And whatever you've got chosen there, that's what VirtualBox gets to deal with. So there are two ways to solve this problem that I know of. One of them is what Andy started talking about here, which is to use Audio Hijack Pro and something called Soundflower. Soundflower is software that emulates a hardware device. And without getting overly geeky about how it's done, he essentially, via software, wired up the right ports coming to and from his audio interface and wired those up to ports on Soundflower. What Soundflower then, he said, selected Soundflower as both his audio input and his audio output. And using Audio Hijack Pro, was able to configure which ports on his physical interface wired up to the ports that VirtualBox got to see via Soundflower. Now that's it. It works, and it's probably your least expensive solution, because I think you're looking at about $40 for Audio Hijack Pro. A more potentially more elegant solution is using something like Wiretap Anywhere, and I think that's like $120, but don't quote me on that. But it's not as cheap as Audio Hijack Pro, but it will create these audio devices by itself, so you don't have to use this third party Soundflower thing, which is limited in and of itself, but worked for Andy's purpose. So, you know, you could inside Wiretap Anywhere, you actually go in and you say, okay, I want to create what appears to the computer to be a hardware audio device, but really it's just software saying route this sound from here to here. And that would work as well. So that's my theory. That's my answer on that.
All right.
We've got some tips and we'll touch on at least a couple cool stuff, found items, because we're starting to do that now to make sure that queue doesn't get overflowing. Are there any other of these questions up top here that you want to, do before we move on to tips, John? Is there one? You want to do the thing from Jeff?
You know, we could, because that I think is a good troubleshooting.
Yeah,
one.
Go. All right. You want me to set this one up for you here, John?
Well, I can set it up.
Yeah, go ahead.
You want to let me set it up?
Yeah,
okay.
Go.
So Jeff, who is on the staff of Backbeat Media,
right. Jeff Q. Yeah.
Actually sent out a little query while I was on Twitter saying, my eyesight doesn't work. And I'm like, that's too bad. Eyesight, of course, being the built-in camera on pretty much any portable Mac and even the iMac. Right, but I believe in his case, and I'm not sure, I thought he was on a MacBook.
He's on a MacBook Pro. That's right.
Okay. And here was his problem. Let me see if I can bring up the letter that he wrote me here, because I copied our Twitter discussion. Yes. So here's how it went. Jeff said, my built-in eyesight camera stopped working. Is it broken or is it possible I turned it off? Now, as far as I know, there's no way to control it or turn it off. Is there a setting for that? And so I said to him, well, one, I told him, well, why don't you go in System Profiler, which, of course, you can go to from the Apple menu. If you hold down the Alt key, you can bring up System Profiler. And last I checked, all iSight cameras are USB devices. So I said, well, click on USB and see if...
The internal ones are. Yeah, there was the old external FireWire iSight, but that's not what he's talking about. That's right.
Right. So the internal ones, like at least on my MacBook Pro, shows up in the USB choice. So if you go to hardware USB, on one of the USB buses, you should see iSight camera or something similar. And he said, no, I don't see that. And I'm like, well, since it's a USB device, I said, and here was the wording. I said, so my only thought is, since it's a USB device, disconnect any other USB devices and see if it shows up. And he said to me, that actually worked. Thanks.
That's awesome.
Then when I plugged my hard drives back in, it stayed on. That part I'm not sure about. And then I said back to him, well, that was a lucky, I mean, I knew that solved your problem. But no, not what concerns me, though, is that, so as you may or may not know, but if you look in System Profiler, USB, every USB bus has an advertised maximum current rating in milliamps. Now, what's concerning me is I think there may be something wonky with his machine. What he did leads me to believe that the USB drives may be, I'm going to guess that they are bus powered. So USB drives can get power from two places. They can either get power from an external power adapter or from the USB bus, but that's limited. And like I'm looking right now, at least on my mini, and it says 500 milliamps.
Right.
And every device is supposed to advertise. So I think what happened is he may have maxed out the power capability or the current capability of the USB bus. And when the camera tried to come online, he didn't get an error. It was just like, yep, can't do it. Now, the fact that he changed the order in which he did things and now it all works. Now, I don't think the machine's going to burst into flames, but it leads me to believe that either he should probably run these drives off of external power versus bus power, because I think he'll run into the same thing again, or something's wonky with his machine. And your thoughts, but I was happy that my initial diagnostic was correct and that he was able to run the camera with nothing else on the USB bus. But I mean, what do you think?
Well, we've seen this before where the camera just dies, right? But you know, sometimes a reboot fixes it, and it is, as you said, you know, very tied to a happily running USB bus. So yeah, this is where I hope he doesn't have a problem, because, well, first of all, we don't like anybody having problems, and especially I don't like Jeff, who's one of our, you know, star salespeople here at Backbeat. I don't want him to be without his MacBook Pro. But I hope that's all it was. Certainly, you know, the wrong power draw. And as you well know, John, those drives will take varying levels of power depending on what they need to do. If both of them need to spin up simultaneously, well, that's going to draw a whole lot more power than if, you know, just one's running and one's asleep and there's no camera running. So he may have hit that perfect storm of all that stuff that made it so that something had to, you know, electronically fall off the USB bus. Hopefully it's not a bad connection inside that, you know, when he was moving the computer as he disconnected it, the rest of the USB, maybe that camera, you know, reseated itself. If that's the case, then that's, you know, the computer's coming apart at some point. Either he's taking it apart or Apple is. But
I mean, it just gets me because there are two aspects to this, and then we should move on. There is the software aspect where each USB device, both the USB controller and all devices, should be advertising how much power they need or how much they can supply. And the OS should be able to detect this. What makes me nervous is that that's software. Now, the software can lie. Like, for example, he may have a drive that's not properly advertising. And maybe this is maybe what's happening to him is it's being enforced by hardware, is that it's physically unable.
Yeah, it makes me nervous. Like that happened this time. That's right.
Because I've seen some devices and, you know, they're either not programmed properly or whatever, but they will say, oh, I'm a USB device and I have seen this saying, oh, my current requirements are 0 milliamps, which is, of course, impossible.
Right.
I mean, every USB device needs some power, last I checked. So, yeah. All right. But anyway, so it worked. EyeSight camera is a USB device. If you have problems with it.
It's a good lesson in troubleshooting, right?
Ooh, you know, I got a troubleshooting tip then, possibly.
Go.
Get one of those powered USB hubs.
Yes.
And plug that in. And then, you know, it has the external power. You know what I'm talking about? It's like a 4-port hub. So if you get a powered USB hub, plug that in and see if that happens. And then that would at least help, you think.
It would definitely help.
Assuming that maybe the drive doesn't have the ability to convert between bus powered and external power.
Right.
You know, if it's only a bus powered drive, then if you could do that, then that may help the troubleshooting issue.
Yeah, for sure. All right. You know, before we get to tips, John, I want to talk about our second sponsor for this show, which is Circus Ponies and Notebook. We've talked about this before. We will talk about it again. Notebook's one of those kind of cool programs that takes a paradigm that works so well in the physical world and moves it to the digital world and actually makes it better. So the idea is the white lined spiral bound notebook that we all took to classes with us and probably still take to classes with us, because that's kind of how we live in a world that's still, you know, very paper oriented. So, you know, you get to class, you start taking your notes, and you, of course, you don't have, it doesn't have to be a class. It could be a meeting. It could be a project you're working on, but something where you would dedicate a notebook to it. Well, move that to the computer. You start with the same white lined view, if you will. But instead of writing, you probably want to type, because you can type faster than maybe you can write, and it organizes everything. If you want to insert pages, no problem. If you want to remove pages, no problem. If you want to take an image that you have that's related, maybe from a web page or from course notes that a teacher provides, you pull it right in. And there it is. It lives inside your notebook. Same thing with audio files. You could record a lecture and pull that in and type it all out and keep your notes right there. Notebook is built to organize all of this stuff about a particular topic coming in different mediums. And you can add stickies. You can pull in a PDF. Let's say the professor or something, or you know, you're working on a project at work, provided with a PDF. You pull that in, and now you've got that in there, and you can annotate that. It's even got a to-do list built in, so you can, if you've got a project going on, you can start adding and then, of course, ticking off things on this to-do list, all inside of this one application on your Mac. So it ties it all together. You can search. And if you know when something was put in, you can search by that. If you know what you typed, you can search by that, and it will find it. What it gets really cool, as if this wasn't cool enough, is when you move it to your iPad. And you can sync notebooks between your Mac and your iPad, and you can edit in both places. So you could bring your iPad with you to class or a meeting or anything like that. Edit there, sync it back to your Mac, edit there, sync it back and forth. Everything's peachy. This all starts at,
I found a new service in it, because I've taken on a new project at work, and I'm starting to use this one new notebook for a project management. And one of the cool things, you talk about importing, but one of the really cool things this has is called a clipping service. And so you can be on a Safari or Firefox web page, then highlight a web page or a portion thereof or something like that, and then go up to the Safari menu and services, and the page in your notebook is available under services. Go, yeah, clip it over to that notebook for me. Boom.
Really?
Just launches it right in there. No cut and paste.
So you don't even have to pick, you pick right from the services menu, which of your
page
notebook
you
is
want it on in the notebook. Yeah, it's slick.
Wow. Yeah. Cool.
So
CircusPonies.com, the notebook for the Mac is available as a free download to try it out. And then it's $49.95, $29.95 if you're a student. So you get a discount there. Notebook for the iPad, of course, there's no free trial because that's not how the App Store works. It's $29.99 and Apple doesn't care who you are. That's the price. So that's Notebook from CircusPonies.com. All right. We got a lot of tips. John, we were recently talking about the modifier keys for our friend who had a keyboard problem, a third-party Logitech keyboard problem. And we talked about the modifier keys button in there. And Tim wrote in, he said, one of the other reasons the modifier keys button inside System Preferences and Keyboard is useful is the remapping of Caps Lock to Control. For people who use Control often, e.g. those people who use Emacs or the Emacs shortcuts built into macOS 10, doing this remapping is very useful. In fact, a lot of Unix systems had this kind of keyboard layout. So just an interesting little tidbit about that there. And that's actually pretty cool. If you had Control where you could lock it down, that's actually kind of cool. So thank you, Tim. Along those same lines, we got a note from Todd talking about the same issue. Now, Todd was the one who wrote in and had this particular issue. And he said, I appreciate the discussion, and I've tried all of those options and haven't gotten anything to actually change the keyboard. However, I found a killer little app that does all sorts of keyboard magic. Double Command, which is one we've talked about here on the show before, I think, John, he says it's a great keyboard modifier program that works as a system preference pane. It hasn't been updated for a couple of years, but it is a 64-bit pref pane. So that meets one of your baseline criteria, right, John? And works in 10.6 Snow Leopard. And he says it also works in the developer preview of 10.7. So he says it's really worth the time to check out. It's doublecommand.sourceforge.net, which, of course, we will put in the show notes. Do you use Double Command, John? I think you were the one that brought it up for a Cool Stuff Found years ago.
I may have, but I don't use it.
Okay.
But I want to toss out a quick tip,
go.
Dave.
Yeah, go.
So all this keyboard stuff, which some people still use the keyboard, not everybody's converted to the iPad and all of that. But I found this. So one thing is I'm exploring development with Xcode, and they have Coco and NS Text View, which is typically the class of a window that shows you text. There's a few cool things you could do. Now, one, which I don't know if it's directly related to Text View.
Yes.
But if you highlight something in most apps that are Coco and you do Control Command D, do you know what that does, Dave?
Well, I do now, but only because you showed me earlier.
It's so cool. It links to the Mac OS X dictionary, and actually, so it brings up a little floating window, and I think there's actually a little pull down where instead of the dictionary, you can say, oh, show me the thesaurus instead.
It's awesome.
So that I just found while I was doing random surfing. And then the other thing, which this gets a little deeper because I was digging into how you can modify the behavior of NS Text View, because we were talking about word completion,
right?
Which was the tip that Nancy gave us in her article. But there's another thing that is not on by default, and maybe this is a good thing in most apps like Mail or TextEdit that support Coco and NS Text View, that there's a grammar checker. And you can invoke this where if you right click or control click, whatever you want to do, and you'll see a whole bunch of things come up, and there is a spelling and grammar menu, and one of them is check grammar.
That's awesome.
Just thought I'd mention that. Is I did not know until I dug into this a little bit and looking at the API and the description of NS Text View that there's actually a grammar checker built into OS X as well. Now, I don't know if it's as good as the spell check. I mean, the spell checker, I think, is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, right.
Or the autocomplete. But it just surprised me that you have all this functionality, and that, you know, that's the beauty of Coco or any framework.
Yes.
Is that, you know, and it's interesting because the project that I'm working on now, which is a basic project that just has a text window.
Yep.
You get all this stuff built in. You have to do nothing. You just say build an app, include NS Text View, compile it, and you get all this stuff. You get a spell checker, you get autocomplete, you get a grammar checker if you choose it as an option. It's just amazing what they include.
That's
to get you started. So
that's how it should be.
It should be, and you can also enable or disable.
Okay.
But it's nice because the framework, like I said, you can build an app that does text editing, and you get all these things, cut, paste, copy, all of that stuff is all built in.
You have to do nothing
to get a basic app. So building a basic text editor is trivial with Xcode.
Because really you're just wrapping around the framework that's
Coco,
already there.
Yeah, because Coco is just building all that into this big Wampen class called a NS Text View class.
Huh.
So good stuff.
Yeah, that's cool.
If you want to, pair stuff out, then I guess you can. And that's the point I'm at right now, is learning how to, you know, disable certain things. And actually I saw it as a challenge. It's like, well, how do I turn these things off if I don't want them?
Right. Right. Cool.
So do we have some more?
We've got a couple of tips. Yeah. So Sarah writes, and she says, I was listening to Mac Geek Gab 323, and you were responding to a question about a Mac App Store. And John, you were lamenting that the App Store badge on the dock doesn't automatically notify you when new versions are available or new updates are available. Also, a listener was disappointed that apps not purchased via the App Store aren't able to be updated through the App Store. Definitely, the App Store needs to make some improvements in order to fulfill the promise of what's set out to be. However, there is a solution. Before the App Store came along, I began using an application called Bodega. It does what the App Store does, but way better. And it uses a notification system to bring up a screen and tell you that the Bodega store has X number of updates available for you. It's a great interface, and not only does it show you the updates available and your current version, but it also provides a get update button for each available update, then downloads and installs the updated app. I continue to use Bodega, and they continue to develop in spite of the presence of the new Apple App Store. Bodega is a better solution by far for those of us that have so many applications purchased long before the App Store came along. And it is appbodega.com. I knew about Bodega. I'd seen it advertised, and I guess I never installed it. So after I read Sarah's email today, I installed it, John, and it's awesome. It's everything she just described. It scoured my applications folder, came up with a list of everything right inside Bodega. And it said, look, these, 15 apps you're out of date on. Here's the version you have. Here's the version that's out there. And she's right. You just click get update and then install, get update, install. And it did, 10 of them in parallel with each other and installed. And now I'm totally up to date. It really is. And of course, then you can buy through it, and that's how they're making their money, which is great. But it's, it's the App Store for the rest of us, if you will. I mean, I think Apple's App Store is obviously going to see the bulk of the traffic, but this is, where you can get things that Apple, maybe just don't fit into their mold of what goes into their App Store. So definitely cool. And the fact that it manages these updates, I know there's a lot of apps that do it, but this is the best interface that for me that I've found so far for doing that. So, but okay. David, thanks, Sarah. Yeah, very cool.
I've done, I don't know how I feel about it. CNET has an app that has changed a little bit, but is also
the old version tracker app.
Yeah, well, now it's under CNET.
Right.
And I think a pref pane, and it will look, and every now and then will come up and say, hey, by the way, and I think they have different versions. The freebie or the cheapskate version will tell you, all right, it shows your web page. Here's your apps. Here's the current version. Here's what you have. Would you like to update it? And it'll send you automatic or I've gotten emails from them saying, oh, the app that you updated through us, there's a new version. So it's kind of nice.
That's cool.
The problem that I've found with a lot of these apps, though, is that either people see the database with bogus data, or they kind of get it wrong as far as parsing the version number. In some cases, they'll tell you there's a new version of something when there's not. And again, I'm not sure of the source of that. Maybe it's people trying to.
Well, I did 10 or 15 updates this morning with Bodega and didn't run into that.
Good.
And it was totally smooth. I mean, it never sent me off to it didn't do it. It was like updating from within the App Store. You just hit the button and then it just did it. There was no user interaction other than agreeing to let it happen.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So maybe they have somebody police the database and the version.
My guess is
to make sure they're actually accurate.
Because they're selling this stuff and making money, they probably have a better relationship with, or a closer relationship to the vendors. So, and then one last thing that actually answers a question that we don't even have to ask. So, Kevin, take it away.
Hey, Mac Geeks, it's Kevin here. I just listened to show 323, and you guys were talking about using Podcaster for the Mac Geek Gab premium feed, and I got it to work. I got a real kind of cool way to do it. So what I did is I took the same premium URL feed out of iTunes, and I just copied and pasted that into an email. Emailed it to myself, and then on the iPhone, I copy and pasted that URL into Podcaster. And if I use the premium Mac Geek Gab URL, then I actually got a little prompt within Podcaster that asked me for my username and password. And it worked really well. I've had no issues. It's downloading all the full feed just like it did in iTunes. And I'm loving Podcaster. It's great. Great app. So I got that to work really well. There's my tip. This is where you cut me off. Have a good day. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Kevin. You described it probably better than I would have. So thank you for doing that. All right. We have we'll do two cool stuff found items. And the first, I think this is cool. Michael sent this in. And I say Michael sent this in, but I don't know which Michael. an app called Jump Desktop. And the best way to see how this works is to go to jumpdesktop.com and watch their little movie. So the idea is you have your iPhone or your iPad and you want to remote control a Mac from them. And there are some remote control and remote desktop apps and that sort of thing. What Jump Desktop does, though, is let's take the iPhone first. You can plug in an external monitor to your iPhone with the new little connection kit that came with the iPad too. So or really with even just the VGA connection kit that exists. So if you do that and then you plug in a Bluetooth keyboard, you use your iPhone screen as the mouse, as the touchpad, and then you've got remote desktop, full monitor, whatever monitor you have your iPhone plugged into, and a Bluetooth keyboard, and it just totally works. But you don't have to carry a computer with you. You're just doing it with your phone, which is pretty darn cool. And again, the video explained this. The iPad version works, I think it's a universal app, so it works on the iPhone or the iPod Touch or the iPad. The iPad version expands to make use of the larger screen. You can actually do full keyboard on it if you want, or you can do a Bluetooth keyboard and then you can do mouse stuff on it as well. So Jump Desktop, it's not cheap for an app. I mean, it's cheap. It's $20, but it's the best remote control paradigm I've seen. I haven't tried it yet. I don't have all the right hardware to make it work the way I want to work, but it looks cool. And the fact that you've already always got that connectivity in your pocket, that's the really cool part. So, did you watch the video, John?
No.
Okay. You'll like it when you do.
Not that video. I've watched many videos.
Okay. Well, that's good. And then Kirk pointed us to a blog post over at tuaw.com, the unofficial Apple weblog, about logging in. If you want your Mac to be secure, you want to disable auto login, right? But the problem with that is, you know, if you're like me and this, the computer we have here in the studio is a perfect example. Once I log into it, there's probably a 3 to 5 minute lag as it, you know, starts up everything. It launches the Finder. It's got to load Dropbox. It's got to do it. It's, you know, iSync, Mobile Me Sync, and it's got, you know, all that stuff's happening. So if I happen to reboot this machine and then walk away and don't come back for a couple of days, it's not logged in. It's not doing any of that syncing. And I'm sort of left behind the eight ball when I come up here to podcast, but I like it to be secure. And of course we use multiple logins because Lisa's sometimes here. So the folks at Tuaw recently, sometime in the last month, posted a little tutorial about turning. What you do is you turn on auto login and then you create this launch agent item that immediately logs you out and sends you back to the login screen, which means the net result is the computer starts up. You're left at the login screen, but one of your accounts, whichever one you designate, is automatically logged in and starting everything up. So when you get back to your computer, you type in your password at the login screen and bam, you're right there and everything's good to go as you wanted it. So we'll post a link to that. We've got a link in the show notes. It's free. You know, you just type this little thing up and you're good to go. So that's, Yeah, I know. And they say that, you know, there were some comments on the story about, well, how secure is this? And the answer is, well, you never have the opportunity to stop this from happening. So, you know, if somebody gets your computer, doesn't matter what you've done to it. They can take the drive out, mount it in another machine. And, you know, unless you've got it encrypted, they're going to get your data.
Right.
So in that sense, yeah, it's no less secure than anything else, but it's interesting. It's time to bring the band in, John.
Yeah, it's a tough one, man.
The band?
I'm sure they were frolicking about.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what bands do. They frolic.
That's right. Yeah, every band I've ever played in, all we do is frolic.
Good.
So we had a lot of comments, a lot of questions, some great tips, and of course, killer cool stuff found. If you have anything you want to send us, here's how. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the email address to use.
This one time I'm going to agree with you, Dave.
So you send your stuff to feedback@macgeekab.com. It can be text. It can be pictures.
No, wait. What did you say? No. Feedback@macgeekab.com.
Dang it. I thought I could slip that second one past you there.
But you're right. Text, pictures, movies. Well, I don't know about movies, but whatever helps us understand your problem or issue or concern.
Yep. 206-666-GEEK is the number to call, and John Geek is
4335.
That's right. And you can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab as well. We get everything that comes in. We do go through everything that comes in, and here's a little secret. We try to reply to everything that comes in, but we don't always succeed there, but we do our darndest.
What else? Comments. iTunes comments. Yeah. We love them.
Yeah, please keep them coming. And you can, so we're going to be off for 2 weeks. You can find us on Twitter. I'm Dave Hamilton, twitter.com/Dave Hamilton. He's John F. Braun. The guy next to me is Pilot Pete. You can find out news about the show at Mac Geek Gab. And then, of course, Mac Observer covers all the headlines from TMO all day long. I'd like to thank Michael Johnston. He hosts the We Have Communicators podcast, and also he takes the time each week and has done so. He's been with us so long. He converts the show to AAC and does a great job with it. So thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. Everybody send your love out to Michael. Michael Johnston on Twitter. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. And the podcast marketplace includes the A5 speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo, and BB Edit from Barebones Software, Text Expander and Text Expander Touch from Smile, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through Backbeat Media. Have a great week, folks, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
Wow. What am I going to do? Oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to pay my taxes. Well, we get an extension, right?
Wait, what?
If you file for one.
Yeah.
18th. Well, no, 18th now. It's the 18th.
The 30th now. Do not accept tax advice from John F. Braun. And if you do.
That's right. If you do accept tax advice from any of the three of us.
Don't get